For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, if you were here last week, we started into this passage and noted that there's so many details to deal with in this that it's kind of hard to organize and break down. But we argued there last week that there is a scenario, there's a collection of things that need to be present in order for the end times description to fit. One of the things was that Israel has to be back in their country after having disappeared as a nation for 2,000 years. In all of the accounts of the end times, the Jews are there in their nation and they have Jerusalem. And so that had to happen. Secondly, globalization. The world needs to move toward a perspective where people are viewing the world as our world rather than my nation. Technology, several specific technologies mentioned in connection with the end times that the whole thing won't work if we don't have those. There are also a collection of stressing factors that it declares are going to be pushing people in the world to feel like we've got to do things differently than we have before. And that's part of the impetus that's going to lead people to accept some of the bizarre things that come down at that time. There's also a description of the sociological changes that are going to come near the end of history and key theological conditions as well. So last week we started with this one. And we saw that particular sign is at hand. Didn't see this coming. This didn't seem very likely that some ancient nation that disappeared for a couple thousand years would reappear. That sounded like fantasy. You can actually read biblical commentators, Christian commentators, as recently as 150 years ago, laughing at this concept. And yet, it's right there, as we saw. We went through passage after passage. And God said, yeah, well, it is going to happen. And so, it happened. This week, we want to bore into the next one down the list here, globalization. Do a little thinking about this. It comes up in Matthew 24 in connection with verse 15 and following. This is kind of one of the hard to understand sections of this discourse. But Jesus said, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through Daniel the prophet, let the reader understand. So this abomination of desolation that causes desolation. Yeah, it is from the book of Daniel. He's referring to a passage in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, where it says that this prince who's going to come, he's going to make a firm covenant with the many. That's probably referring to the Jews for a seven-year period. But in the middle of the seven, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. This is the passage Jesus is referring to. There you see the abomination that makes desolate, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And the guy who... this is a particular sin that's related to defiling the temple of God. And that's why Jesus says, when you see standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation. The holy place is a reference to the temple in Israel. This statement implies, for one thing, that the temple that used to be there, the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, is going to be rebuilt. Now, how is that going to happen? When there's a big mosque sitting right where the old temple used to be, I don't know. Maybe they'll build it in a different place. However it's going to happen, if it says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But this guy, this prince who is to come, mentioned in Daniel, is none other than the man of lawlessness, as he's called by Paul, or the beast, or the Antichrist. This is the guy that comes up repeatedly in connection with discussions of the last days. You notice the expression here, in the middle of the seven. That is, if you take 7 years and cut it in half, what do you have? Two segments of 3.5 years each. That becomes important in identifying this guy. Let's compare that passage to what it says about the same guy in Revelation chapter 13. This isn't a class on eschatology, so I'm just going to have to skip through some things and try to tie them together for you, and recommend that you take a class like LTC 4 if you want to really get down deep and dirty into this material. Anyway, in this passage it says, "Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed." Okay, I'm not going to back this up. I'm just going to tell you that if you analyze this and the other passage in 17, that is referring to the fact this fatal head wound that's healed is not a literal head being wounded. It is referring to the fact that the thing that happened to Israel, where they were an ancient nation, they disappeared for a long time, and then they reappeared. Something similar to that is going to happen with the Roman Empire. It's going to reappear after being gone for hundreds of years. And we read that the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. The whole earth. They're very explicit on this point. Verse 7 says that he was given authority over every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Four different ways of saying everybody minus nobody follows this guy. People worship the dragon. People worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast and who's able to make war with him?" This worshiping may not refer to actual religious worship, because the word here means to prostrate or to bow before, and it may just mean they submit themselves to his leadership. Not sure. Maybe they do worship him. But there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. Well, 42 months, let's see, 12 times 3, 36 would be 3.5 years. That's right. This last 7 year period looks like the first half of it, the beast leads the world. Then there's this thing called the abomination of desolation. And then the last 3.5 years, the unity of the world breaks down and war breaks out, and it leads to the campaign of Armageddon. That's why Jesus says, when you see that abomination of desolation, get out of there as fast as possible. And chapter 17 later, discussing again the same guy, the beast, it talks about how peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues follow him. And it says in 17, "For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdoms to the beast." So this is a really bizarre prediction, really far out, that everyone in the world would give, forget about their own nation and turn it all over to this one world entity led by this charismatic figure, the beast, and he's an evil one. He also, we read, forced everyone, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, the free and the slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead. And he provided that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. So this mark on the hand or the forehead, and you can't buy or sell anything without that mark. Again, very remarkable, very strange, especially set in its setting. This was written about 90 AD, okay, so nearly 2,000 years ago. And we have to imagine ancient people reading this and just being like, what the heck? How could any empire, like the Romans, they were pretty high in control, but they couldn't control what someone in a village sold to another friend or something. I mean, you know, there was no way that any government has ever been able to do that. And yet here it's pretty clear that if you don't have this mark, you cannot buy or sell at all in the last days, in this last period. So this is what Jesus is referring to. We're back in Matthew 24 now when he says, and he's expecting the reader to understand what, you know, what these allusions to the beast. And he says, when you see that, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back in to get his cloak. Forget the cloak. Just run. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. It's going to be hard for them to run like they need to. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. Because you're going to have to break the Sabbath if it is. For then there would be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be short. And so this event of the abomination of desolation is linked with something called a great tribulation. This great tribulation, that's the last 3.5 years of human history as we know it. And we're going to be learning some things about that period. It's really bad. And the worst thing is this war that's going on, which he says is so severe that if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. No one would survive. A war so vicious it could kill everyone on earth. Okay, so to get though, and so this is the guy who unifies the world. The whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. How would we ever get to, you know, especially if you have a sense of some kind of a sense of history, you know, that tribes, nations, and so forth have just continually warred with one another. Efforts to unify even segments of the globe have never been successful for very long. That humans are inherently divided from one another. Yes, we have had world rulers, empires where, you know, leaders dreamed of, taking over the world and ruling it. They've never come that close, really. And yet here it's saying, well, this guy's going to succeed where everyone else failed. Seems like a really far-fetched prediction that this could ever happen. That the whole world could get together. Is that possible? Yes, it is. And I'm going to argue to you that already the pieces are being put in place that are going to head down this pike uniquely in our day, like never before. The case for a one world mentality is growing. And it's going to reach a point where the logic of one worldism is going to become irresistible. Here's why. First of all is the need that we have for it. The world, as we reach the end of history, according to the New Testament, has a lot of problems. One of them is overpopulation. This comes up in the book of Revelation in chapter 16, or chapter 9 rather. Where they talk in during this is during this great war that happens, and he says that the number of the armies of horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. He says, I heard that number. That is not a typo. That's the number, okay? Now, 200 million people fighting. Not that they're all from one country. I think this could be from all sides put together. But still, That is an insane number. Consider that in World War II, which was kind of, you know, that was easily the most maximum war we've ever had in the history of the earth, all combatants on all sides put together was about 50 million. This is four times that, 200 million. This is an astonishing number. How could an ancient person even write something like that? You know, you can't just send everyone out to fight in a war. Soldiers need a large number of people. You have to have 15 or 20 people at home for every soldier you put in the field to produce the materials to supply, and non-combatants and so forth. This number implies a population of billions on the earth at the time that this event happens. It clearly implies that. Well, you know, the population of Earth has really been relatively stable throughout most of its history. If we go back 10,000 years, like this chart here, a lot of people are not aware that we never reached a billion people on Earth until 1830. That was when we first reached 1 billion. The second billion showed up 100 years later. So 10,000 years to reach 1 billion, 100 years to reach 2 billion. The third billion, 30 years later in 1960. The fourth billion, only 15 years later in 75. 5 billion in 85, so that one was only 10 years. And the sixth billion in 96. Today we're at 7 billion. And counting. The growth of population has slowed. Not enough, I'm afraid. It's still going up quite rapidly. And we all authorities agree that we're going to probably reach at least 9 billion people. And some say 10 billion. And that is not in several hundred years. That is in your lifetime. By 2050. It's not that. That's 40 years from now. Now, I'd like you to just ponder the direction that that line is going right there. That is not good. That is insane. That is crazy. And so much for the theory that all these Bible prophecies are just referring to things that happen every so often. They just keep happening. Nothing's really different. They always think it's the end of the world. I don't think this ever happened before. I think we would know it if it had. This has never happened in history. It has only happened within the past century. And there we have a confluence. And of course, this is one of the problems that's driving a lot of the other problems that are hitting the human race right now, such as hunger. Hunger is directly related to this. This authority, Nan Unkelsbay, writes, July 11th, 1987, world population reached 5 billion. From July 11th, 87 to July 11th, 88, 1 year, world population grew another 83 million people, an increase greater than the population of Mexico. Every year, it's like another Mexico thrown into the mix. Mexico's a pretty big country. They got a lot of people there, too. In those same 366 days, arable land diminished by 8,700 square miles, an area greater than twice the size of Jamaica. A lot of people aren't aware of that, that arable land that you can farm on is decreasing constantly in our world. The world's farmers are trying to feed almost 90 million more people a year with 24 billion fewer tons of topsoil, an amount equal to the soil of all of Australia's wheatland. It's called desertification. It's where poor populations cut down the trees so they have something, a fuel to cook with, and also to farm so they can farm on that land. These are often poor soils that are being held in place by those trees. Once the trees are gone, the soil is eroded, and you end up with a subsoil that is that lacks nutrients and simply can't be farmed anymore. It's so degraded, we can't grow anything on it. And so this is happening all over the world. And the other thing that destroys soil and takes arable land out of cultivation is when you continually irrigate land, it's salinization. You start to end up with salt in the soil because of the continual concentration that happens when the water's evaporating and you keep putting more river water in. Same thing that happens in the Dead Sea. So what we have is we have this exploding mushrooming population, but a decline in arable land. This is a British professor in a recent address this year says that a perfect storm of food shortages, scarce water, and insufficient energy resources threaten to unleash public unrest, cross-border conflicts, and mass migration as people flee from the worst affected regions, the UK government's chief scientist warns. Our food reserves, he says, are at a 50-year low. But by 2030, we need to produce 50% more food. At the same time, we need 50% more energy and 30% more fresh water. Where is that going to come from? Fresh water? Water is one of the big problems that we're facing. A lot of countries, especially in semi-arid and arid areas, have been tapping aquifers that have millions of year-old reserves of water, vast quantities of water, but they're running out. And this is one of the things that's happening in the Near East. A lot of people didn't notice this, but the recent spate of riots in the Near East didn't start because people were like, we want democracy. That is not the reason. The reason they were rioting is because of food prices. They were hungry. And the Near Eastern governments can't, you know, they've used the water up in a lot of these areas, so they buy grain. And grain has been soaring in price by 50% during the past few years. And it's driving people to hunger in the poor countries of the world. This is a diagram showing what's happening to the marine fish catch. And you can see how it went up for a number of years and then now has just leveled off. Or if you look at the North Atlantic, it's actually declining year by year. That's because of pure overfishing. That's all it is. And this is a huge worldwide problem because this is one of the top sources of protein in the world. An international group of ecologists and economists warned yesterday that the world will run out of seafood by 2048 if steep declines in marine species continue at current rates. They found that by 2003, the last year for which data on global commercial fish catches were available, 29% of all fish species had collapsed, meaning they're now at 90% below their historical maximum catch levels. We can look for this to happen in one area after another. The Earth simply was not designed to sustain the number of people that are on it. This is arable land versus population. The chart on the right shows that the arable land per person has been declining steadily since 1961. And so, even though not just a few years ago, we could still say that there's more than enough food for everyone on Earth. The problem is distribution. The problem is the financial aspect of it, which is that people are too poor to buy the food. Today, we're running at the end of that, and the food resources are declining to the point relative to the population that things are going to get a lot worse. One of the reasons for this, well, I'm going to hold off on that. This is a map showing degraded soil in various areas of the world. In the West, a lot of our soil is degraded because of constant irrigation and overuse of commercial pesticides and fertilizers. Living Planet Report, 2004, put out by Cambridge. In it, they state that humanity's demands now exceed our planet's capacity to sustain us. Humans have destroyed more than 30% of the natural world since 1970. Good Lord. How do they get that number? I'm not sure, but I mean, that is a hellacious number. It could be true. If you travel in some of these areas, like I've traveled in the Amazon basin before, I went there thinking, you know, and I really wanted to see a true, you know, three canopy rainforest. And I told the buddy that I was visiting there that that's something I really wanted to see. We had to journey for a day and a half just to get to a woods, because everywhere you went, it was just smoking logs lying on the ground, you know, for tens and scores of miles. And when you see it, you realize they're really, and you know, if you go up to these are poor peasants that are trying to survive, and they have to fell, they do use slash and burn agriculture. And if you tell them, you know, these are pretty old trees, you shouldn't be doing this and stuff, they're trying to feed their family. They don't care about that. They're in survival mode. And this is happening all over the world. Consumption pressure has doubled in the past 25 years and continues to accelerate. How about that one guy claiming that we're going to have to produce 50% more food, you know, by 2030? Where's that going to come from? You see that we're in a situation, and of course, you know, the people that are most alarmed about this whole situation are the people that study it. The people that are like, crap, whatever, are usually the most ignorant people on the subject that have never cracked the books. You can't study this. All the people that are authoritative when it comes to the ecosphere and the state of world agriculture are alarmed, and they're the ones that see a huge catastrophe heading straight toward us. All you have to do is look at that growth chart of population, and you know something bad is going to happen. That can't just keep going like that. Pollution, that's another reason there's a need to solve our problems. See, these problems that we're facing are not local problems. They're worldwide problems. And so, you know, like we think of population growth, we don't have a population problem in the U.S. Our population is only growing through immigration. We don't even grow biologically anymore. Neither does Western Europe. But that's not where the problem is. The problem's in the developing world. So, you know, for us to cut down, let's say we decide to have fewer kids, it isn't going to make any difference. That won't affect anything. These are problems of a global nature. They need a global solution. People, hear a lot today about the growth of carbon dioxide levels, which is, again, this is a measured, provable increase. One of the things that we really learn today as we study the world situation is how interrelated everything is. One of the reasons for food shortages and for the dramatic increase in food costs over the past few years is Western worry about the carbon footprint and the desire to use less carboniferous fuels such as alcohol. So biofuels are becoming an increasing drain on grains and cereals being used to produce alcohol. And it's taking those off of the market, which increases demand relative to decreases supply, which increases the price. This is one of the reasons that prices are going up and that people are starving and that we're having food riots. The need for some sort of extranational, global solution to these kind of problems, and we could spend weeks studying them, because I'm just giving you a smattering here, is intense. Secondly, There's a mentality shift going on as we speak, where the old perspective, where, you know, screw those people, they're not even human over there, we're the only ones that matter, our tribe, our nation, our whatever, is dissolving and is disappearing. Multiple factors are leading toward a congealing of the entire human race into what you might refer to as a one world mentality, where people see this not as just my nation, but that it's our world. One of the biggest drivers is the globalized economy. This is all new. This has all happened in the past couple or three decades, definitely since World War II. Henry Wendt is the former president of Bank of America. He says the emergence of a full-blown global marketplace in which goods, money, people flow easily back and forth across national borders and around the world comes as a shock. Suddenly, the volume of world trade has reached staggering proportions. The world, he says, is integrating at a dizzying pace. National borders grow fuzzier and in many cases more irrelevant with each passing day. If your economy is based on the whole world, not based on your country, then how much does your country's boundaries matter anymore? You know, here's Barnett and Mueller. They say the men who run the global corporations today are the first in history with the organization, the technology, the money, and the ideology to make a credible try at managing the world as an integrated economic unit. What they are demanding, in essence, is the right to transcend the nation state and in the process to transform it. For these vast multinational companies, you know, whether it's American, Chinese, Canadian, or whatever, they couldn't care less. They're not interested in it. They have no national loyalty. They've got branches in every one of those countries that they're trying to make profitable. And the goods and materials are flowing, and the capital flowing at incredible speed. It's not clear that anyone, even the national governments, could slow globalization even if they wanted to. Of the world's 100 largest economic entities, more than half are no longer countries, but companies. For instance, Walmart's revenues in 2005 were $285 billion, larger than the combined GDP of sub-Saharan Africa. Good Lord, that's over 30 countries put together, couldn't match one corporation in their GDP, not profitability or tax base. This is their GDP, gross domestic product. All goods and services in those countries, 30 of them put together couldn't match Walmart in size. So this is like the elephant and the flea, right? I mean, these corporations are so vast, it just boggles the mind. Joseph Stiglitz is probably one of the world's leading authorities on this subject. He won the Nobel Prize for economics. He was the chief economist for the World Bank for quite a number of years, also in the Clinton presidency he was his economist. He stresses the need in his book, this is Making Globalization Work, a book from a year ago. He says, he stresses the need for international frameworks and international courts. They're as necessary for the smooth functioning of the global economy as federal courts and national laws are for national economies. In fact, you see this with all the authorities writing about this field, is that there's been this exponential explosion of international trade. You know, at the end of World War II, the average national tariff rate was 40%. So if you wanted to ship into Mexico or the U.S., any of those countries, it was your cost plus 40% more because it wasn't made here. As of 91, the average tariff internationally was 5%. and falling rapidly. It's down lower than that now. The reason? Countries don't want to be left out. The whole idea that we can protect our economy is now gone. And every country on earth is scrambling to get a piece of this globalized economic action that is, this is where the money's at today. And so the authorities and the guys that are movers and shakers in this all see the need for international rules. It's like a Wild West right now where anything goes. Corruption, bribery, and cheating, all up on one side and down the other. And then you have something like the corrupt U.S. housing market, where they're lending all this money to people that they knew perfectly well couldn't pay it. And that brings down the whole world. And the same thing happened a few years ago when the Asians were overextending and having bank failures. And the next thing you knew, the Asian bank crisis hit, and it rippled clear across the whole world and resulted in a worldwide recession. This is what's happening today. And it's because our economies are interwoven to an extent that has never been true in history, not even a tenth, not even a hundredth of what it is today. And so with that is a growing need to have international enforcement, you know, law enforcement, protection for the people that are risking trillions of dollars in capital. He says, globalization means that events in one part of the world have a ripple effects elsewhere, as ideas and knowledge, goods and services, and capital and even people move more easily across borders. As the countries of the world become more closely integrated, they become more interdependent. Greater interdependence gives rise to a greater need for collective action to solve common problems. I think that should be self-evident. The more our economies are woven together and depend on one another, the idea of just doing what we want over here in our little region no longer makes sense. And we've got to be concerned with what they're doing. They've got our money, and we've got their money. And so the whole thing in that weaving together, it cries out for regulatory agencies and institutions that can get some kind of control over this. Stiglitz says, as the world becomes more globalized, more integrated, there will be more and more areas in which there are opportunities for cooperative action and in which such collective action is not only desirable but absolutely necessary. In effect, he says, economic globalization has outpaced political globalization. Yeah, that's exactly what's happened. And all the authorities working in this field are like, we've got to catch up with the economic part and add a political piece, a governing piece. We have a chaotic, uncoordinated system of global governance without global government. There's such a clear need for strong international institutions to deal with the challenges posed by economic globalization, and yet today confidence in existing institutions is weak. It hasn't happened yet. And so you have this Wild West, anything goes marketplace, and everybody's money is all tied up in that and vulnerable. How long is the world going to put up with this? David Corton, When Corporations Rule the World, a real interesting book. He says the past two decades have seen the most rapid and sweeping institutional transformation in human history. Quite a statement to think about. Think about that statement. It's true. I'm certain it's true. There's never been anything like this because it embraces the whole world. It is a conscious and intentional transformation in search of a new world economic order in which business has no nationality and knows no borders. Do you see how this would lend toward a mentality of openness to a one world governing solution? It absolutely does. And this is where all the money is. And when the people with money think something is necessary, it usually happens. Alvin Toffler says, old safety mechanisms designed to maintain financial stability in a world of relatively closed national economies are as obsolete as the Rust Belt world they were designed to protect. Doesn't do any good for us to regulate our stock market to avoid a 1930s-style depression. If the rest of the world doesn't regulate theirs, it'll hit us just as hard. It's all integrated now. Everything has changed on that. A second area leading to this mentality of acceptance, of willingness to view the world as one rather than separate entities, has to do with information technology. This is one of the most staggering developments that we live with. Think about it. Anyone today can make direct contact with anyone else in the world, pretty much, and probably have their picture, have them there, talking to you live on the screen, certainly on the phone. That has never been true. It has never been true until our own day. You realize that. The internet and the global economy is also causing English to become kind of the international trade language. Every country that you go to, if you do a lot of international travel, people want to learn English. It's like one of the most coveted skills to have is to be able to speak English, because that's where the money is. And that's where the jobs are. People can get jobs. If you're good at English, you can get a job in any country in the world. So poor countries are thirsting to know English, teaching it in their schools. And increasingly, you can travel into strange countries and people will talk to you in your own language there. Trade, communication, and understanding are growing exponentially in our day. The internet didn't even exist 20 years ago. It existed, but it was only used by government and military. No one even knew about it. 20 years ago, I remember that. I remember my brother saying, what do you think of the World Wide Web? I was like, what's that? This was in 1993 or 94. And he gave me a little floppy disk with something called Mosaic on it. And I ran it up and started, checking out websites. It was the beginning of the internet. And people were just catching on to it. Everything that we see today has happened since then. Nobody even knew about it. Look at this in Revelation chapter 11. This is one of the technologies that's predicted for the last days. It talks about how these two guys die, and it says in verse 9, for 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. What a wild statement. Wait a minute. This statement was written at a time that it would take several months just to journey from one end of the Roman Empire to the other. When this was written, they didn't even know about most of the world that it even existed. And yet it's very explicit. Every nation, people, language, and tribe, everyone. How intense can it be? And it's not just that they hear about it or read about it. It's that they gaze upon them. And this is all happening in a 3.5 day episode. How's that possible? That's nothing for us. We do that all the time. That's what's happening right now. Everyone in the world is watching what's happening in Japan right now. And so we're used to that. And yet here is a description from ancient times predicting that that kind of thing is going to be possible at a time. This must have been baffling to the ancient readers to read that. Travel today is as easy as can be, as fast as it can be. It really, people, not only the rich, but even normal income people are doing international travel. Probably most of us here have done some international travel. And that used to be something that only a tiny elite could do. Entertainment is another force here. Any traditional culture that you visit, if you travel today, you can go into the poorest cities, and people there have cell phones. And they've got the web on the cell phone, too. They've got a computer at home with the web on that. They're thoroughly familiar with one of the things, like a lot of them don't appreciate a lot of things that come from America, but one thing they all thirst for is the entertainment that's produced in the West. The movies, these foolish TV serials and stuff play over there. You see American stuff and Western stuff playing all over the place. And it's being imitated, the clothing, the dress. Basically, younger people in these cultures don't want to follow the traditional way anymore. They want to be like the West. And so you're seeing a rapid shift there, an abandonment of traditional ways of life that has existed for thousands of years. And now just within a few decades, people are switching over and want to live. They want that life they see on that screen. They want that for themselves. And they're fighting, they're striving to get it. This is all new. This wasn't this way just a short time ago. It's all happened real recently, and I think it's leading. I think it contributes to this mentality that I'm referring to. We have institutions today that are being built, institutions like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which governs the flow of capital and currencies around country, the World Bank. Loans money to poor and developing countries. The WTO is the World Trade Organization. They're trying to set up these rules that can govern the globalized economy. And so there's this mentality building. I've never seen anything like it. It's all happened within my lifetime. Thirdly, so there's the need for globalization, there's the mentality in favor of globalization building, and there's the ability to globalize. That's something new as well. Think about that passage we read in Revelations where it says that he will cause a number to be put on everyone's forehead or hand, and they cannot buy or sell without that number. Boy, that's really high control there. Everyone on earth would have to have a specified identity. That would have to be a colossal computerized system to run something like that. Yeah. One of the things that Stiglitz points out is that bank secrecy aggravates the problems of corruption, providing a safe haven for ill-gotten gains. In the aftermath of the East Asian crisis, that's when the East Asian banks went belly up, there were calls from the IMF and the U.S. Treasury for greater transparency in the Asian financial markets. That's what's going to increasingly happen, is that we can't just have people doing wild and crazy things. Here is a recently approved chip that can be implanted subcutaneously and can give you a digitized identity. Identity theft. One of the hugest problems in developed countries where people can steal billions of dollars by stealing people's identity online. A solution is needed. This is one. This is with the pinch of a syringe, the microchips inserted under the skin and a procedure that takes less than 20 minutes and leaves no stitches. There it is, stuck it right in his hand there. Is this what they're talking about in that passage? I don't know. It could be something like this. What about this? Here's an interesting piece here about how India launches a project to identify 1.2 billion people. And it talks about how their vaunted tech savvy is being put to the test this week as the country embarks on a daunting mission, assigning a unique 12-digit number to each of its 1.2 billion people. Here's one of the pictures here. He's taking a retinal scan on this girl, holding that thing to her forehead. There they're doing it for an old man. They put that gizmo on that scans their retina. Biometrics. Isn't that interesting? One person suggested recently, maybe the forehead, you know, it mentions the forehead and the hand. What if it's biometrics? Because you put the thing on the forehead to read your retina, or you use a thumbprint on your hand. I don't know. We don't. But I think it's pretty wild that they would try to do it. They must believe they can do it. They do believe they can do it, and they will do it. There you see an entire, that's the second biggest country in the world. And they're going to have a digital identity in that country. This is where, you know, when we get systems like this built, that kind of infrastructure, it makes possible. Yes, this would be an absolute solution to the problem of international terrorism. If the only way to buy anything was by, cash transfer, computer transfer, and you had to have an identity, a digital identity in order to do that, well, how would a criminal even steal money in the future? There would be no money. This would be awesome. There's plenty of reasons to think that things are headed this way. And it's something to really watch. Globalization, I think this is at hand. I think it's happening as we speak. Maybe it's not completely there, but I think the conditions that would lead to it are there. Technology, some of the technologies predicted in the Bible, one of them that we talked about tonight, having a number on each person. Another one to where everyone on earth could watch the same event over a few days period. What would that require? Not just television, it would require satellite technology, an infrastructure that would be worldwide. This has only been in place since probably the 90s, where something like that could literally happen. It's a very recent development. I think when it comes to the technology, and there's more, I'm going to give you some more on this next week, I think it's at hand. The technologies described are with us. I haven't said anything about nuclear technology, but you probably have sensed that's implied in Jesus' statement. These stressing factors that are building, that are going to force people to reconsider traditional ways of doing things and to accept solutions they never would have considered before, I think are at hand today. I think we're seeing that. And as we approach 9 billion people on Earth, the stress is going to increase dramatically. I'm going to save the rest for next week. Let's just try to draw a couple of conclusions on what we're seeing. None of these things that we're talking about seem very likely, 2,000 years ago, or let alone 3,000 years ago when some of them were written. And certainly not 2,000 years ago. People couldn't have imagined any of these things. Israel coming back, disappearing as a nation, and coming back, that didn't seem very likely. People all around the world watching the same thing at the same time, I don't know how that's going to happen. Imagine this. 2,000 years ago, they're writing this. Interestingly, even 200 years ago, it would have been just as improbable. 200 years ago would be like 1811. People were still riding horses. If you wanted to go to China, you'd have to get on a sailing boat. And you might make it there within 2 or 3 months. If you wanted to communicate with somebody in China, all you could do would be to write him a letter and hope it got there over a 3 to 5 month period. But when he opened it, he wouldn't be able to read it because it's in their own language. There basically was no way to communicate with people on the other side of the world as recently as 200 years ago. In fact, as recently as 50 years ago, almost none of the things on this list were present. 50 years. I mean, Israel was a nation, but they didn't have Jerusalem. That was what Jesus said was the key. Maybe they had nuclear weapons, but they weren't capable of destroying all life on Earth. Almost all of this has come into place just in the past few decades. I think that's astonishing. It wouldn't have seemed very plausible up until recently, and yet God said this is what's going to happen. And so when God says something's going to happen in His Word, it happens. It happens like he said it. Now, let's not forget God also said that Jesus is going to come back. That's what this whole discussion started out with. They said, what is the sign of your coming and the end of the age to Jesus? That's what he's explaining here. Predictive prophecy is not given to us for our curiosity. It's not a parlor game or something. It's supposed to alert us to the key movements of God in history and specifically to Jesus Christ. It's all about Christ when you come right down to it. Who is it that comes in and rescues the human race? At the climax of this drama, it's Jesus Christ. In fact, this whole, all of that discourse, as we get to the end of the chapter, the punchline of the whole thing is, so you need to be ready for the coming of the Son of Man. That's what this discussion is about, being ready for the coming of the Son of Man. To be ready for the coming of Christ as a personal spiritual transaction between each of us and God. Rescue is not going to be institutional. It's not going to be passing the right laws. It's going to be a matter of getting that personal relationship with God going. And that comes strictly based on the free gift of grace, based on the work of Christ. It's an act of faith where you call out to the Lord and say, I want to have a relationship with you and I want to be part of your body. I want to be part of the winning side on this whole thing. And God says he's going to rescue his people. We will be rescued. That's how it's going to work. And so we'll need to study that too. What does it really mean to be ready for the coming of the Son of Man? Lot to think about there. But I guess we'll just have to draw the line here for tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.